And Christian, I guess first thing I'll ask you is just, you know, for any of our listeners who may not have heard Jazz Night before, how would you describe it to them?
Well, I always like to call Jazz Night in America the 60 minutes of jazz, you know, because when you watch 60 minutes, you really get in-depth stories. You actually go deep into the real root of the presentation, the who, the what, the where, and most importantly, the why, you know. And so I really think we give the most thorough stories and entertaining and interesting stories in jazz.
Yeah, I took a listen to the show that aired over the weekend, the first one that our listeners on WIOL got to hear. And appropriately enough, it featured Dede Bridgewater, who's got some Champaign Urbana ties. And I really enjoyed how, you know, it kind of delved into, you know, her history, her background, working with artists like Abby Lincoln, among many others, and just kind of delving into, you know, how she got to where she is now.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of the whole Champaign-Urbana connection, my in-laws also went there the same time Dee Dee did.
Wow.
Melissa's parents went there. I believe they got their doctorates there in 1970, I believe it was. And so that's a great school. I've played there many, many times. And with specific regards to Dee Dee, I mean, you know, she was the voice of the longest running jazz radio program. Well, next to Marion McPartland. Marion McPartland will always be the queen. After Marion, Dee Dee Bridgewater was the voice of Jazz Set for, I believe, over 20 seasons. And so I'm doing my best to, you know, make myself worthy in her footsteps.
Well, and you know, you keep such a busy writing and performing schedule, Christian, that I'm curious how you found the time to get into broadcasting.
It was purely by accident. I never had any plans on getting into broadcasting. As I say, I'm still just a bass player, man. You know, that's how I got to this dance. And that's how I assume I'm going to leave this dance, you know, as a bass player, first and foremost. But I don't know, a couple of things started happening. One thing led to another, that led to something else. And then here I am as host of Jazz Night in America. But I was actually called in to be a sub for John Schaefer, who hosted a show called Soundcheck for many years on WNYC. And I don't know how they got around. I think maybe because I subbed for Marion McPartland on Piano Jazz a number of times, they may have heard it or just heard something that I'd done. And so they had me sit in as the substitute host for a soundcheck for 3 days on WNYC. And that was different than anything I'd ever been involved in before or since, because that was, at that time, it was live. Mm. And so here I am hosting a show on New York Public Radio in the middle of the afternoon, live. I have never been so scared in my whole life. And, you know, I had to give, like, the, you know, what, forget just hosting the show. I had to, like, do all the news leads and stuff like that, you know. Oh, so wow. Here I am interviewing Greg Reporter, and then I got to talk about Vladimir Putin as we were about to break the commercial, you know. So, I think that really kind of set the tone for, like, oh, okay, he actually can do this. He did it live, you know. And then my man Josh Jackson, who used to be at WBGO, he's now at WRTI in Philly. He said, "Hey man, you want to host this show I'm putting together?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." And that was Jazz Night in America, and that's where I met my dear friend, who's the senior producer of Jazz Night in America, Katie Simon, and we've been one big happy family for the last 7 years now. Time is flying.
Yeah, it always does. Before our conversation today, I went back and listened to a few of your albums that are in my library.
No, I'm starting sorry with to hear
your,
that.
No, it was great. starting with your first album as a leader, Getting to It. You know, it's been just a few years since that recording. I'm curious what you might remember about that particular session.
Oh man, I remember everything about that session. First of all, it was my first album as a leader. Or a CD, as we would say in 1994. I'd been in the studio with a bunch of people at that point, but here I was recording my own music under my own name. And having my friends on that recording made it a little easier. You know, having Roy Hargrove and Joshua Redman and Lewis Nash and Cyrus Chestnut. Steve Turay was also on it, but I looked up to Steve. I still look up to Steve as like a mentor, you know. I had admired him on records for many years with Woody Shaw and other people. But everybody else in that band, they were, you know, those were my boys, you know. So they made it easier for me to go into the studio and record my own music. And then, of course, it was I was quite fortunate to have Mr. Ray Brown and Mr. Mill Hinton play one bass duet with me on that. So everything about those sessions were just pretty memorable. I still have somewhere around here, I have the old DAT tapes of the complete sessions, all the outtakes, all the studio banter, all of that.
Oh, fun stuff. Yeah. The arrangement you did with Ray and Milton Splanky, definitely a memorable one. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Roy Hargrove, because, you know, we just lost Roy, you know, a few years ago, way too young. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, he was a close friend. I'm just curious what memories you really hold dear from Roy.
Too many. I mean, you know, we met in high school at a national big band competition back in 1987. And even in those days, long before text messaging, even before email, you know, when you actually had to sit down and write someone a letter or a postcard, or you had to get permission from your mother to make a long distance phone call, you know, we managed to stay in touch a little bit. He was a year ahead of me. He graduated high school, class of 88. I was class of 89. And we both kind of got to New York City at the same time. You know, within 6 or 7 months of each other, his career just exploded, and he had me in his very first touring band, and so it's impossible for me to think of my first few years in New York, you know, finding my way as a jazz artist in the New York maze, and not think of Roy Hargrove, because we were there together at the same time. You know, and over the course of over 25 years, there were a lot of projects we did together, a lot of recordings, a lot of different all-star projects. You know, I have nothing but great memories of that amazing, amazing person and musician.
recent years, you also worked a lot with the late Chick Corea, who just passed away, you know, in February. The album you worked on with him recently, Trilogy 2, just won Best Jazz Instrumental Album at the Grammy Awards. You know, how would you describe what it was like to work with Chick?
I think all of these people, you know, people like Roy Hargrove, Chick Corea, obviously Chick was much, much different in the sense that he was an icon already by the time I met him. I first met Chick in the early 90s, and, you know, it's like you wanted to bow to him, you know, you're a hero. And he was the most, if the phrase can be comprehensible, he was the most regular icon you could ever imagine. Very approachable, very sweet, very kind, a real everyday kind of person. At least I found him to be that way, particularly when we were on the road. It was very difficult to not think of him as just one of the guys in the band, you know. At least that's certainly how it was when I worked with him. A lot of times when I worked with Chick, Roy Haynes was playing drums. Mm. And when Roy Haynes is in the band, it's his band, whether it's his band or not, you know. And so it was very sweet to work with either one of them individually, but to play with them together, man, I was the happiest person on the planet, you know. And Chick was, you know, he looked up to Roy Haynes. Well, I mean, we all look up to Roy Haynes, but to see the way Chick really respected and was so deeply humbled by Roy Haynes, to me, that gave a window into who Chick Corea was, because it was Chick's band, right?
Yeah.
But Chick was always like, Roy, what do you think? Are you okay with this? Do you think we need to change anything? You know, and I thought that was very kind, because I know a lot of band leaders who aren't that kind, and it doesn't matter if there's a legend like Roy Haynes playing in the band.
Yeah, yeah. You know, also in recent years, you've released three albums as the leader of the Christian McBride Big Band. The most recent of those just came out last year for Jimmy, Wes, and Oliver. I'm curious what appeals to you about big bands, about leading one, about writing for one.
My foray into big band writing and being a big band leader is similar to my career development as a broadcaster, as a radio host. I think I had a little more intent with big bands than broadcasting, but I was always interested in learning how to write for big band, to learn how to orchestrate. Like, what do you do with 16 horns and make it sound good? That's fascinating to me, you know. So I would pull my metaphorical, you know, hat down over my eyes, you know, and I said, I'm going to get into this hole and learn something. I'll buy all these books. I would get with great big band writers and say, okay, you got a B flat 7 sharp 11. What do you do? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I started secretly, you know, working on these big band charts, or whatever you want to call them. And Wynton Marsalis, one day, he says, hey, I want you to write something for the Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra. I'm going, don't I get a warm-up band first? You know, you know, let me write for a band a little less heralded, you know what I mean? Just so I can work out the kinks. You know, he's like, nope, going to write it for us. And so that was in December of 1995. And I just wrote one piece for the orchestra. And Wynton really liked it. He says, you know, make sure you keep practicing this. You know, you got something, you know. And I did. I kept practicing. And in the late 90s, I became a regular guest of a guest clinician at the Henry Mancini Institute, which at that time was at UCLA. It's now at the Frost School at the University of Miami. But at that time, Jack Elliott, the late great film and television composer who created the Mancini Institute, He and Justin DeChocho, who ran the jazz program at the Manhattan School of Music, they said, "Hey, man, we hear you've been secretly working on some big band charts. Bring them to the summer program." And so I started, you know, that sort of became my lab. And I mean, Justin used to really grill me all the time. He's like, "Look, we're not inviting you back unless you write something for the big band." I was like, "Wow, okay." So, you know, they call and say, "Hey, we want to get your schedule for next summer so you can come back out." And then that would be followed up with a call from Justin saying, "How many big band charts you got? Because if you don't have any, you're not coming." You know? And so next thing I knew, I had enough material for a record. And so I said, "Well, I might as well record them. Let me see what happens." And then voila, all of a sudden, I'm the leader of a big band.
Yeah, and all you did was win a Grammy Award for that one, too. So, hey, not too shabby for your first one, huh?
Not too shabby.
You know, I also wanted to ask you just about the last year. I mean, with the pandemic, you know, essentially shutting down just about all live performance, you know, what kind of an impact has that had on you? You know, what kind of an impact do you think that's had on jazz as a whole?
Well, the toll has been devastating. To really think about the number of musicians that we have lost over the last 13 months is, it's really hard to sit down and think of people. I don't even want to start naming names, because if you start naming names, you'll forget someone who, you know, shouldn't be forgotten. And I remember at one count, this was back in maybe January or February. I think the count was maybe 55. Notable jazz artists that passed away from COVID. That's before Chick Corea died, you know. That's before Milford Graves passed away. That was before Johnny Pacheco passed away, who all passed away in mid to late February. And so on that end, I think a lot of that won't be felt until we're all able to actually get back out there and start playing again. And you start going to these festivals, you start going to these recording studios, you start going to these clubs, and you don't see musicians that you're used to seeing. So I think it's going to be a delayed effect on the losses of so many great people. On the other hand, if there's a silver lining in the middle of this, personally, it's been a joy to not be on the road for the first time in over 30 years. So I actually get to know what my house feels like. I actually get to say hello to my wife in person every day. That's never happened before, you know. So I haven't been in one place for this long a period since my senior year in high school. And you know, we're very careful. You know, we never go out anywhere. So we've done I think, a very good job at staying out of harm's way. And so with that, I very much have enjoyed being off the road and being able to just rejuvenate my body and my brain. But at the same time, the death toll has been quite devastating, not just on the whole world, but specifically in the jazz community, which is a very tightly knit small community anyway. So
yeah, Of course. So do you have anything marked down, you know, when live performances are able to return? Do you have anything kind of marked down on the calendar, like, okay, I want to be here and this is the group I want to perform with? Do you have anything in mind yet?
Well, a couple of things. I have one thing coming up in early May, outdoor concert up in Ridgefield, Connecticut. We're hoping to have, we're still not quite sure yet, but we got the green light from the governor of Rhode Island to have some sort of a festival at Newport this summer. We don't know exactly what or who or how, but, we're crossing our fingers that we can put something together for that. And I have my annual residency at the Village Vanguard, which is scheduled for December. And, I'm crossing my fingers and I'm going to think positive that by December, hopefully we'll be able to play in the club, obviously with limited capacity, and slowly return to some semblance of familiarity, and hopefully by next year, we'll really get back to that tempo that we're used to.
For sure. I think we're all looking forward to that. I know it's been over a year since I've been able to go out and see live music, and I'm really looking forward to having that opportunity again. So I think we all are.
I see. Are you a Cubs fan?
I am. That is Wrigley Field behind me there. Yeah, my virtual background. Yeah. You have a baseball team?
Phillies, baby. Phillies all the way.
All right. I can respect that. You're Philly born and bred, of course, right?
That's right. That's right.
All right. All right. Very good.
I made my first visit to Wrigley Field just before the pandemic, actually. It was, the summer of 19.
Yeah. And can't wait to get back to Wrigley as well.
And I got an obstructed view ticket. And and they weren't joking.
No, there are definitely some obstructed views still at Wrigley. It's one of the few that still has those. So,
oh man.
All right. Well, hey, I'll leave it there, Christian. But really enjoyed talking with you today. Thanks for being so generous with your time.
My pleasure.